Sustained applause showed that the meaning was not lost on his audience. Goebbels had been thrilled on more than one occasion in 1926 by Hitler's exposition of the social question. Always new and compelling was how Goebbels described his ideas. In reality, Hitler's social idea was simplistic, diffuse, and manipulative. It amounted to little more than what he had told his bourgeois audience in Hamburg, winning the workers to nationalism, destroying Marxism, and overcoming the division between nationalism and socialism through the creation of a nebulous national community, Volksgemeinschaft, based on racial purity and the concept of struggle. The fusion of nationalism and socialism would do away with the class antagonism between a nationalist bourgeoisie and Marxist proletariat, both of which had failed in their political goals. This would be replaced by a community of struggle where nationalism and socialism would be united, where brain and fist were reconciled, and where, denuded of Marxist influence, the building of a new spirit for the great future struggle of the people could be undertaken. Such ideas were neither new nor original, and ultimately they rested not on any modern form of socialism, but on the crudest and most brutal version of 19th-century imperialist and social Darwinistic notions. Social welfare in the trumpeted national community did not exist for its own sake, but to prepare for external struggle, for conquest by the sword. Hitler repeatedly stated that he was uninterested in day-to-day issues. What he offered over and over again was the same vision of a long-term goal to be striven after with missionary zeal and total commitment. Political struggle, eventual attainment of power, destruction of the enemy, and build-up of the nation's might were stepping stones to the goal. But how it was to be then attained was left open. Hitler himself had no concrete notion. He just had the certainty of the fanatical conviction politician that it would be attained. Clarity was never aimed at. The acquisition of living space through conquest implied at some distant future date aggression against Russia. But it had no more precise meaning than that. Hitler's own firm belief in it need not be doubted, but even for many of his followers in the world of the mid-1920s, with Germany engaged diplomatically with the Soviet Union following the Rapallo Treaty of 1922, as well as improving relations with the Western powers through the 1925 Treaty of Locarno, then membership of the League of Nations, this must have seemed little more than sloganizing or a pipe dream. Even on the Jewish question, the wild tirades, vicious as they were, offered no concrete policies. Getting rid of the Jews, Entfernung der Juden, could only reasonably be taken to mean the expulsion of all Jews from Germany, as when Hitler called for chasing that pack of Jews from our fatherland with an iron broom. But even this aim seemed less than clear when Hitler stated, to tumultuous applause from the stalwarts of the movement gathered in Munich's Hofbrauhaus on the 24th of February 1928 to celebrate the 8th anniversary of the launch of the party program, that the Jew would have to be shown that we're the bosses here. If he behaves well, he can stay. If not, then out with him. In the Jewish question, the question of living space, and the social question, Hitler suggested a vision of a distant utopia. He did not chart the path to it, but no other Nazi leader or Volkish politician could match the internal unity, simplicity, and all-encompassing character of this vision. His sense of conviction, he spoke frequently of his mission, faith, and of the idea, combined with an unrivaled talent for mobilization through reduction to simple black-white choices, was where the ideologue and the propagandist came together. The interdependence of the various strands of Hitler's pernicious worldview is most plainly evident in his second book, an updated statement of his views on foreign policy, left in the event unpublished, dictated hurriedly to Max Amann during a stay on the Obersalzberg in the summer of 1928. Hitler felt prompted to produce the book by the heated debates at the time about policy towards South Tyrol. Under Mussolini, fascist policies of Italianization of the largely German-speaking area had stirred strong anti-Italian feeling in nationalist circles in Austria and Germany, particularly in Bavaria. Hitler's readiness to renounce German claims on South Tyrol in the interest of an alliance with Italy had seen him attacked by German nationalists, as well as being accused by socialists of taking bribes from Mussolini. Hitler dealt with the South Tyrol issue in Mein Kampf and published the relevant sections from the second volume as a separate pamphlet in February 1926. When the issue flared up again in 1928, Hitler was driven to outline his position at length. Probably financial considerations, Amann may well have advised against having the second book compete against the second volume of Mein Kampf, with its disappointing and diminishing sales, dissuaded Hitler from publishing the book. But in addition, as the South Tyrol question lost its urgency, new issues like the Young Plan arose, and Hitler had neither time nor inclination to revise the text. It may have been felt that its publication would have offered political hostages to fortune. If occasioned by the South Tyrol question, the second book went far beyond it, ranging more expansively than Mein Kampf had done over Hitler's broad ideas on foreign policy and territorial issues, Raumfragen, linking them as always with his racial interpretation of history, and in the final pages with the need to destroy what he saw as the threat of Jewish domination. But the second book offered nothing new. As we have seen, the essence of Hitler's worldview was fully developed by the time he completed the second volume of Mein Kampf in 1926, existent in embryonic form in fact since late 1922. The ideas dominating the second book, including the issue of South Tyrol and his interest in the growing economic power of the United States of America, were repeatedly advanced in Hitler's speeches and writings from 1927 onwards. Several passages from these speeches recur almost verbatim at key points in the second book. Long before the dictation of the second book, then, Hitler was a fixated ideologue. His own inner certainty of the truths about history as racial struggle and Germany's future mission to obtain living space and at the same time eradicate the power of the Jews forever were of immense importance as a personal driving force. Their significance in attracting support for National Socialism can, however, easily be exaggerated. The growth of the NSDAP to a mass party had little directly to do with the arcanum of Hitler's personalized worldview. More complex processes have to be taken into account. 4. At the end of January 1927, Saxony became the first large German state to lift the speaking ban on Hitler. On the 5th of March, the Bavarian authorities finally conceded to the pressure to allow Hitler to speak again. One of the conditions was that his first public speech in the state should not be held in Munich. Consequently, when on the 6th of March he spoke publicly in Bavaria for the first time in 2 years, it took place well away from Munich at Wilsbiberg in the backwaters of Lower Bavaria. Many of the 1,000-strong audience, only two-thirds filling the hall, were party members and SA men who had been brought from outside to ensure the occasion was a success. But 3 days later, he was back in Munich, in the Circus Krone again, for the first time since 1923. Everything was done to make it a theatrical success. The huge hall was nearly full to its 7,000 capacity by the time Hitler, in a brown raincoat, preceded by marching SA men, accompanied by his retinue, took the rostrum to the sound of fanfares. Most of the audience were from the lower middle classes, though some were plainly well-to-do, their wives in fur coats. A good number were young, many of them dressed in windjammers. The crowd went wild at Hitler's entrance, standing on chairs and benches, waving, shouting Heil, stamping their feet. Around 200 stormtroopers in serried ranks with banners filed past Hitler, greeting him with the fascist salute. Hitler returned the greeting with outstretched arm. The speech met with the usual euphoric applause. The audience regarded Hitler's comments as gospel, even though what he said could have been nothing new to them. The police reporter was less impressed. He thought the speech long-winded in structure, repetitive, with dull passages, and illogical arguments full of crude comparisons and cheap allusions. Nor was Hitler's performance as a speaker, studied with theatrical and exaggerated gestures, to his liking. He was only surprised that Hitler had been so highly praised if his speeches had been similar in 1923. The applause in his eyes was directed not at what Hitler had to say, but at the person of the speaker. Some of the dullness of Hitler's speech was because he was unduly anxious to avoid any comments likely to land him in further trouble with the authorities. The report of the speech in the Völkische Beobachter was surprisingly short. The shorthand writer who had taken it down had lost her notes. For his next big speech in Munich at the end of the month, the Circus Krone was only between a half and three quarters full. Another week later, on the 6th of April, only 1,500 were present in a hall that accommodated almost five times that many. Hitler's magic was no longer working, even in Munich. Outside Munich, his return to the public arena caused little of a stir. In Ingolstadt, earlier a party bastion, Hitler's renewal of his speaking activity was scarcely noted by the population, not even by most of the former supporters, it was reported. Other reports from the Bavarian provinces indicated little interest in the NSDAP for all its vigorous propaganda. Party meetings were often badly attended. In January 1928, the Munich police reported that the advances of the National Socialist movement repeatedly claimed by Hitler are not true, especially in Bavaria. In reality, interest in the movement, both in the countryside and in Munich, is strongly in decline. Branch meetings attended by 300 to 400 people in 1926 now have an attendance of at most 60 to 80 members. Even the party rally, held for the first time at Nuremberg on the 19th to the 21st of August 1927, despite careful orchestration for maximum propaganda effect, failed to raise the expected level of support or interest. Most other German states followed the examples of Saxony and Bavaria in lifting the ban on Hitler speaking in public. Only Prussia, the largest state, and Anhalt held out until autumn 1928. The authorities, it seemed, with justification, could believe that the Nazi menace had passed. Hitler no longer appeared a threat. Though outwardly making little or no headway in the more settled political climate of the mid-1920s, as Germany's new democracy at last showed signs of stability, significant developments were taking place within the NSDAP. Eventually, these would help to place the party in a stronger position to exploit the new economic crisis that was to hit Germany in autumn 1929. Most importantly, the NSDAP had become a self-conscious leader movement focused ideologically and organizationally on the Hitler cult. In retrospect, the leaderless time of 1924 and Hitler's obstinacy, born out of weakness in refusing to take sides in the internecine strife of the Völkisch movement, had been enormously advantageous. The defeat at Bamberg of those looking to programmatic changes was, as we have seen, at the same time the victory of those loyalists prepared to look no further than Hitler as the embodiment of the idea. For these, the program detached from the leader had no meaning, and as 1924 had proven, without Hitler there could be no unity and hence no movement. This point alone was sufficient to persuade even those like Gregor Strasser, who retained their critical distance from Hitler, that the Führer cult had to be built up in order to hold the party together. An outward sign of the unity invested in the person of the leader was the German greeting of Heil Hitler with outstretched arm, the fascist-style salute increasingly used since 1923 and compulsory within the movement since 1926. The Heil Hitler greeting, Strasser wrote in January 1927, was not only a symbol of personal dependence on the leader, but contained in itself the pledge of loyalty. The great secret of the movement was the combination of the inner devotion to the idea of National Socialism, a glowing faith in the victorious strength of this doctrine of liberation, of redemption, with a deep love of the person of our leader who is the shining Duke of the new freedom fighters. Duke and liege man, he continued. In this ancient German, both aristocratic and democratic, relationship of leader to companions lies the essence of the structure of the NSDAP. Friends, raise your right arm and cry out with me proudly, eager for the struggle and loyal to death, Heil Hitler. For Rudolf Hess, For years, a submissive, fawning Hitler devotee, the leader cult was a matter of deep belief, even psychological necessity, not just functional value. In a letter to Walter Hühl, later to be one of Ribbentrop's right-hand men in the foreign ministry, Hess reminded him of the leadership principle that Hitler had already outlined while they were all in Landsberg: unconditional authority downwards and responsibility upwards. He called it Germanic democracy. He underlined the importance of the image of discipline, unity, and strength. He ended by comparing the great popular leader with the great founder of a religion. His task was not to weigh up pros and cons like an academic, not to allow freedom to reach alternative judgments. He must communicate to his listeners an apodictic faith. Only then can the mass of followers be led where they should be led. They will then also follow the leader if setbacks are encountered, but only then if they have communicated to them unconditional belief in the absolute rightness in the mission of the Führer and of their own people. Hitler idolatry was deliberately fostered by the party leadership. In a booklet published in 1926, Goebbels, well on the way, as we have seen, to becoming that very year a worshipper of Hitler, used mystical language redolent of German romanticism and the ideology of the pre-Nazi youth movement to describe his leader as the fulfillment of a mysterious longing, bringing faith in deepest despair, a meteor before our astonished eyes, working a miracle of enlightenment and belief in a world of skepticism and despair. But such sentiments, whatever their propaganda intent, obviously struck a rich vein among the rank-and-file membership. A war veteran dated his Führer worship to Hitler's speeches during his trial in 1924. "From that time on I had no thought for anyone but Hitler. His behavior moved me to give him my whole faith without reserve." One party member who heard Hitler speak in Bonn in 1926 thought he evoked the feelings of every good German. The German soul spoke to German manhood in his words. "From that day on I could never violate my allegiance to Hitler. I saw his unlimited faith in his people and the desire to set them free." A Russian refugee, a former aristocrat, also heard Hitler speak in 1926 in Mecklenburg. The content of the speech evidently left no mark on him, but by the end, he was crying with emotion. A liberating scream of the purest enthusiasm discharged the unbearable tension as the auditorium rocked with applause. The longing for authority and subaltern mentality was widespread in those who found appeal in the early Nazi movement. Romantics, neoconservatives, those fixated on mythical glories of the past, despairing and resentful of the present, dreaming of a heroic future, could all find hope in a coming great leader, a national redeemer. Whether such individuals looked subconsciously to a monarch, a military commander, a statesman, a priest, or simply a father figure, their naive feelings about the need for authority, bringing with it, they imagined, the yearned for national unity, were hugely magnified by the evident divisions in Weimar politics and society, which could only too easily be exploited by the nationalist right. The search for the strong man was commonplace in interwar Europe as part of the assault on democracy. It is not surprising that it was at its most vehement in the two democracies, Italy and Germany, that experienced the deepest crises of pluralist politics. The establishment of the Führer cult was decisive for the development of the Nazi movement. Without it, as 1924 had shown, it would have been torn apart by factionalism. With it, the still precarious unity could be preserved by calling on loyalty to Hitler as a prime duty. Among the party leadership, feelings had to be subordinated to the overriding need for unity. When there was criticism of Hitler, and Ludendorff was advanced as the greater man in a dispute in the Hanover Party in April 1927, Karl Dinklage, the deputy Gauleiter and an important party speaker, wrote, "We in Gauhanover retain our loyal following to Hitler. It's quite immaterial whether we think Ludendorff or Hitler is the greater. That's left to each one of us to decide." And when a serious conflict dividing allegiances in the faction-ridden Berlin party arose in June that year, the loyalty card was played once more. The bitter dispute was occasioned by the competition between Goebbels's new Berlin newspaper, Der Angriff, The Attack, and the struggling Berliner Arbeiterzeitung, Berlin Workers' Newspaper, edited by Gregor Strasser. It rapidly degenerated into the trading of personal insults between the two former allies, gratefully exploited by the Nazis' political enemies. The row dragged on until the winter. It was ended when Hitler brought both rivals to Munich to offer to a packed Hofbräuhaus their public demonstration of unity, bolstered by the common belief in a lofty, holy mission and by the feeling of loyalty binding them to the common idea and also to the common leader in the person of Adolf Hitler. Party members were told that the authority of the idea and the authority of the leader had become one in the person of Adolf Hitler. Within the movement, the SA had always been the most difficult element to control, and so it would continually prove, down to 1934. But here too, Hitler was successfully able to defuse trouble by invoking loyalty to his own person. In May 1927, he made an impassioned speech to the Munich stormtroopers, demoralized and rebellious towards the SA leader Franz von Pfeffer. At the end of his speech, he resorted to his usual ploy. He stepped down from the rostrum, shook hands with each SA man, and gained their renewed pledge of personal loyalty to him. Clashes over strategy, factional disputes, personal rivalries, all were endemic in the SDAP. The interminable conflicts and animosities, normally personal or tactical, rather than ideological, almost invariably stopped short of any attack on Hitler. He intervened as little as possible. In fact, the rivalry and competition simply showed him, according to his own concept of social Darwinist struggle, who among his competing underlings was the stronger. Nor did Hitler make any effort to reconcile ideological nuances within the party, unless they threatened to become counterproductive by deviating the single-minded drive for power through mass mobilization into sectarian squabbling. The Führer cult was accepted because it offered all parties the only remedy to this. Personal loyalty to Hitler, whether genuine or forced, was the price of unity. In some cases, Nazi leaders were wholly convinced of Hitler's greatness and mission. In others, their own ambitions could only be upheld by lip service to the supreme leader. Either way, the result was that Hitler's mastery over the movement increased to the position where it was well nigh unchallengeable. And either way, the transmission belt within the party faithful had been manufactured for the subsequent extension of the Führer cult to wider sectors of the German electorate. The leader cult was indispensable to the party. And the subsummation of the idea in Hitler's own person was necessary if party energy was not to be dissipated in harmful factional divides. By avoiding doctrinal dispute, as he had done in 1924, and focusing all energies on the one goal of obtaining power, Hitler could, sometimes with difficulty, hold the party together. Along the way, the Führer cult had developed its own momentum. Though he fully recognized its propaganda value, Hitler himself was on occasion forced to intervene to prevent absurdities of excess, which only brought merciless lampooning from his political enemies. Hitler's supremacy now paid dividends in its impact on his former rivals. In February 1927, Graf Reventlow, one of the most prominent members of the DVFP, whose social revolutionary position had brought him into increasing conflict with the more conservative German nationalist leadership around Graefe and Wulle, joined the NSDAP. He was accompanied by Wilhelm Kube and Christian Mergenthaler, the leading figures in the DVFP in Brandenburg and Württemberg, respectively. Another Reichstag deputy, Franz Stöhr, also deserted the DVFP in favor of the NSDAP. Hitler and Goebbels traveled to Stuttgart to welcome Mergenthaler personally into the party amid festive scenes. As one who had earlier crossed swords with Hitler, Reventlow's justification for joining the NSDAP was significant. "I have gone over to the National Socialist German Workers' Party without so-called leadership claims and without reservations. I subordinate myself without further ado to Herr Adolf Hitler." Why? He has proved that he can lead. On the basis of his view and his will, he has created a party out of the United National Socialist idea and leads it. He and the party are one and offer the unity that is the unconditional premise of success. The previous 2 years have shown that the National Socialist German Workers' Party is on the right road, that it is on the march, that it possesses unbroken and unbreakable social revolutionary energy. It amounted to the seal of approval on the leadership principle and the merging of the idea and organization in Hitler's person. The process was still not complete by the end of 1927. However, the Nuremberg Party rally in August 1927 depicted Hitler's mastery over the movement more emphatically than had the Weimar rally a year earlier. Hitler could afford to be relaxed about conflicting programmatic statements put forward by the arch-ideologues Feder and Rosenberg. Even Arthur Dinter, who a few weeks later was to be removed from his post as Gauleiter of Thuringia, and then the following year expelled from the party altogether, was allowed to speak, and received a favorable notice in the Volkische Beobachter. What passed for discussion at Nuremberg fell within the broad contours of the Nazi actionist program. Anti-liberal, anti-Marxist, emotionally anti-capitalist, and national socialist, not least anti-Semitic. As long as doctrinaire theorists did nothing to hinder this broad appeal of the party, and nothing to challenge Hitler's leadership position, they were left a good deal of room for maneuver. In the case of Dinter, however, the strength of Hitler's position became plain. Though once a powerful supporter of Hitler, Dinter's religious obsessions — he insisted upon National Socialism being a religious reformation through purification of blood and race — incurred increasing unpopularity within the movement, especially in Thuringia, his own Gau. Hitler felt compelled, therefore, to remove him as Gauleiter in September 1927. Dinter, as fanatically obsessive as Hitler, persisted. The religious neutrality, which Hitler could not afford to endanger, was placed in jeopardy by Dinter's high profile and publicity. When, finally, Dinter challenged Hitler himself, accusing him of being a tool of the Catholic Church and advocating a Senate to advise the leader, he had gone too far. Amid booing, his proposal was unanimously rejected by the General Members' Meeting in September 1928. Even then, it was typical of Hitler that he was reluctant to expel Dinter, knowing the adverse publicity the expulsion would bring. Dinter refused, however, to accept Hitler's exclusive authority and publicly attacked him and the party program. His expulsion in early October 1928 was then inevitable. Strikingly, Gregor Strasser secured a written statement signed by at least 18 Gauleiter expressing unanimity with Hitler's decision. In this situation, Strasser's letter to the Gauleiter ran, "There must be a clear expression to the public, opponents, and especially our own party comrades, that every attempt to establish even the smallest difference of opinion in this question of principle, the mixing of religious issues with the political program of the movement, between Adolf Hitler and his fellow workers, is an impossibility." No less revealing was Hitler's self-description in a letter he wrote to Dinter the previous July. "As leader of the National Socialist movement, and as a person who possesses the blind faith of someday belonging to those who make history," Hitler wrote, "I have, as a politician, the boldness to claim for myself in this sphere the same infallibility that you reserve for yourself in your religious reformationist area." He put the time at his disposal to attain power and shape Germany's fate, at least as regards the racial problem, at most at 20 years. With the build-up of the Führer cult, Hitler's image was at least as important as his practical contribution to the modest growth of the party in the wilderness years. Of course, a Hitler speech remained a major event for a local party branch, and Hitler retained the ability in his mass meetings to win over initially skeptical audiences. But whatever limited success the NSDAP enjoyed before the Depression cannot simply, or even mainly, be attributed to Hitler. As an agitator, Hitler was distinctly less directly prominent than he had been before the putsch. The speaking ban was, of course, a major hindrance in 1925 and 1926. He spoke at only 31 meetings in 1925 and 32 in 1926, mainly internal party affairs, a good number of them in Bavaria. In 1927, his speeches increased in number to 56, more than half of them within Bavaria. Most of his 66 speeches in 1928 took place in the first 5 months, up to the Reichstag election. More than two-thirds of them were held in Bavaria. During the whole of 1929, as the NSDAP began to gain ground in regional elections, he gave only 29 speeches, all but 8 in Bavaria. One limitation on Hitler's availability as a speaker in these years was posed by his frequent trips to try to establish important contacts and drum up funding for a party with chronic financial problems. Not surprisingly, for a party in the political doldrums, his efforts met with little success. Though, not to the liking of the social revolutionaries in the NSDAP, he courted Ruhr industrialists and businessmen in a number of speeches in 1926 and 1927, which went down well. They showed little interest in a party that seemed to be going nowhere. The Becksteins and Bruckmanns, long-standing patrons, continued to give generously. But the aged Emil Kirdorf, whom Frau Bruckmann had brought into personal contact with Hitler, was almost alone among leading Ruhr industrialists in sympathizing with Hitler to the extent of joining the NSDAP and in making a sizable donation of 100,000 marks that went a long way towards overcoming the party's immediate financial plight. As would remain the case, the party was heavily dependent for its income on the contributions of ordinary members. So the stagnation, or at best slow growth, in party membership meant continued headaches for the party treasurer. As earlier, Hitler paid little attention to administration and organization. Party bosses were resigned to his lengthy absences and inaccessibility on even important concerns. He left financial matters to his trusted business manager Max Amann and the party treasurer Franz Xaver Schwarz. Behind the scenes in Munich, Hitler could rely in the party's secretariat upon the indefatigable and subservient Philipp Bauer, the retiring but inwardly ambitious individual who was later to play a central role in the emergence of the euthanasia action. Above all, it was Gregor Strasser as propaganda leader between September 1926 and the end of 1927, during which time he streamlined and coordinated propaganda activities throughout the Reich, and especially after he was made organizational leader on the 2nd of January 1928, who built up, from the faction-ridden and incoherently structured movement, the nationwide organization that from 1929 onwards was in a position to exploit the new crisis conditions. Hitler's part in this development was minimal, though placing Strasser in charge of organizational matters was one of his more inspired appointments. Hitler's instinct, as ever, was for propaganda, not organization. His feel, when it came to matters of mobilizing the masses, seldom let him down. As director of party propaganda, Gregor Strasser had been given a great deal of scope, Hitler's usual style, to shape the character and pattern of agitation. Following his own leanings, Strasser had made a strong push to win over, especially the urban proletariat. Even to outside observers, it was plain by autumn 1927 that this strategy was not paying worthwhile dividends and was at the same time in danger of alienating the lower middle class support of the NSDAP. Reports came in from Schleswig-Holstein, Thuringia, Mecklenburg, Pomerania, and other areas indicating that growing unrest in rural areas offered promising terrain for the NSDAP. Hitler was evidently well informed, and at a meeting of GAU leaders on the 27th of November 1927 in the Hotel Elephant in Weimar, he announced a change of course. He made plain that significant gains could not be expected at the coming election from the Marxists. Small shopkeepers, threatened by department stores, and white-collar workers, many of them already anti-Semites, were singled out as better targets. In December 1927, Hitler addressed for the first time a rally of several thousand peasants from Lower Saxony and Schleswig-Holstein. In the new year, he himself took over the position of party propaganda leader. His deputy, Heinrich Himmler, undertook the routine tasks. The future overlord of the SS Empire was at this time still in his 20s, a well-educated and intelligent former agricultural student who had briefly worked for a fertilizer firm and reared chickens. With his short back and sides haircut, small moustache, round glasses, and unathletic build, he resembled a small-town bank clerk or pedantic schoolmaster. Whatever appearances might have suggested, he had, however, few peers in ideological fanaticism and, as time would prove, cold ruthlessness. The young nationalist idealist, already imagining dire conspiracies involving the Red International, Jews, Jesuits, and Freemasons ranged against Germany, had joined the NSDAP in the summer of 1923, influenced by the man whose murder he would orchestrate 11 years later, Ernst Röhm. It was at Röhm's side that on the 8th of November that year, the night of the putsch, he had carried the banner at the head of the Reichskriegsflagge unit engaged in attempting to storm the Bavarian War Ministry. From the time of the party's refoundation, he had been active, initially as secretary to Gregor Strasser, then from 1926 as deputy Gauleiter of Upper Bavaria Swabia, and deputy Reich propaganda leader. In the latter capacity, in the later 1920s, he was also deputy Reichsfuhrer SS from 1927, before being appointed to lead the SS 2 years later. He proved both efficient and imaginative, apparently coming up with the idea of blanket propaganda coverage of a specific area during a brief period of time, something that became a Nazi hallmark. But significantly, and in contrast to his normal habits, Hitler intervened directly in drafting texts and in shaping central propaganda. In April 1928, he corrected the interpretation of point 17 of the party's unalterable 1920 program. Expropriation without compensation meant, for a party based on the principle of private property, merely the creation of legal means to take over land not administered in the public good. That is, Jewish land speculation companies. The shift in propaganda emphasis was less dramatic than the transformation of a failed urban plan into a rural nationalist plan, but it did amount to a further move away from a programmatic stance directed primarily at winning workers from Marxism to a broader, catch-all approach to mobilization. It was a pragmatic readjustment, recognizing the possibility of a widened appeal to a variety of social groups not previously addressed in any systematic way in party propaganda. The suggestion to move in this direction came, as we have noted, initially from several Gauleiter, recognizing the potential support in their own non-urban regions. Hitler's positive response to their suggestions accorded with his own opportunistic approach to mobilization. Unlike some in the party, wedded to a type of social revolutionary emotive anti-capitalism, which social groups were attracted to Nazism, was for him a matter of indifference. The important thing was that they were won over. Hitler's aim was to gain power. Any weapon to that end was useful. But it did mean that the NSDAP became even more of a loose coalition of competing interest groups. Only the absence of a clear program and a set of utopian, distant goals built into the image of the leader could hold them together. For a time. 5. Few Germans had Hitler on their mind in Weimar's golden years of the mid-1920s. The internal developments within his party were of neither interest nor concern to the overwhelming majority of people. Little attention was paid to the former Munich troublemaker, who now seemed no more than a fringe irritant on the political scene. Those who did take notice of Hitler were often dismissive or condescending, or both. Not untypical was the comment of Germany's leading liberal daily, the Frankfurter Zeitung, casting, as usual from time to time, merely a contemptuous eye in the direction of the National Socialists. Hitler has no thoughts, no responsible reflection, but nonetheless an idea. He has a demon in him, ran an article in the newspaper on the 26th of January 1928. It is a matter of a manic idea of atavistic origin that pushes aside complicated reality and replaces it with a primitive fighting unit. Naturally, Hitler is a dangerous fool, but if one asks how the son of a petty Upper Austrian customs officer arrives at his craze, then one can only say one thing. He has taken war ideology perfectly literally and interpreted it in almost as primitive a way that one might be living in the era of the Völkwanderung, the period of barbarian invasions at the end of the Roman Empire. The results of the Reichstag election on the 20th of May 1928 appeared to confirm the correctness of those commentators who for years had been preaching the end of Hitler and his movement. The electorate showed relatively little interest in the campaign, a reflection of the more settled conditions. As many as 32 parties put up lists, many representing specific interest groups. Hitler would later make great play of this to parody the workings of pluralist democracy. The clear winners were the parties of the left. Both the SPD and KPD made significant gains. The most serious losses were suffered by the German nationalists, DNVP. Small parties and splinter groups won, cumulatively, almost twice as many votes, 13.9%, as they had done in December 1924. With its miserable return of 2.6%, the NSDAP won only 12 seats. Electorally, it had lost ground compared with the Völkischer Bloc in December 1924. In the cities, with a handful of exceptions, the results were disastrous. Despite Goebbels's efforts to take the fight to the red districts in Berlin, the Nazis won only 1.57% of the vote in the capital city. In red Wedding, typical of working-class districts of the inner city, the NSDAP's 1,742 votes paled against the 163,429 votes cast for the parties of the left. But there were some rays of light. The returns from some rural areas, as anticipated, held out hope for the future. The best results, apart from the traditional Franconian heartlands and parts of Upper Bavaria, were mainly to be found in the North German countryside, afflicted by the deepening agricultural depression. In Weser-Ems, for example, assisted by the propaganda razzmatazz of the tub-thumping, virulently anti-Semitic unfrocked pastor Ludwig Munkmeier, a convert from the DVFB, the vote for the NSDAP was twice the national average. Even in eastern Germany, where support remained very low, the loss of confidence in the dominant DNVP gave some grounds for optimism. Finally, there was at least the consolation that the 12 Nazis who entered the Reichstag now had immunity from legal action for their venomous attacks on opponents and, if anything even more important, daily allowances and free rail passes for first-class travel on the Reichsbahn to ease pressure on party finances. Among the new deputies were Gregor Strasser, Frick, Feder, Goebbels, Ritter von Epp, the former Freikorps leader, a new much-trumpeted convert from the BVP, and Hermann Göring, recently returned to the fold after his absence since the putsch. "We are going into the Reichstag, like the wolf into the sheep flock," Goebbels told his readers in the Angriff. There was understandable disappointment and dejection within the party, but the public response was one of resilience. Lessons were to be learnt. It was as obvious to Gregor Strasser as to other party leaders that the concentration on the industrial working class had not paid dividends. Richer potential lay in the countryside. The need for a readjustment of party propaganda and organization was plain. Hitler reinforced the message at the leaders' meeting in Munich between the 31st of August and the 2nd of September, replacing the party rally, which lack of funds following the election campaign did not permit in 1928. He announced a thorough reorganization of the Gau structure, according to Gregor Strasser's plan. Under Strasser's organizational leadership, greater attention was paid to the countryside, and first steps were taken in constructing a panoply of affiliated sub-organizations that became extremely important in tapping the specific interests of middle-class groups. Hitler's own reaction to the election disaster was characteristic. On election night itself, in a packed meeting in the Bürger Braukeller, flanked by Epp and the recently returned Röhm, he rejoiced first in the dismal showing of rival parties. The first conclusion from the election, he stated, was that there was now only a single Völkisch movement, the NSDAP. He emphasized the fact that in Munich the party had gained some 7,000 votes compared with December 1924. The poor results in almost every other city were not mentioned. As a second consequence, he underlined the large increase in the Marxist vote after 3 years of government by the Bavarian People's Party and the German Nationals. He contrasted this with the fall in the vote for the left in Munich in 1924. Finally, he added a defiant third conclusion. "The election campaign is fought, the struggle continues. For us there is no rest, no break. We carry on working." In fact, Hitler left within days for a holiday in his mountain retreat to recuperate and dictate his second book. He was forced to authorize a statement on the 27th of June to editors of the National Socialist Press, reaffirming his commitment to the legal path to power, after the poor election result had led some to the conclusion that the party would again seek power through violent action. Otherwise, he remained out of the public eye until early July. The election results confirmed to many observers that the Hitler movement was finished. The Prussian government also thought so. At the end of September, it lifted the ban preventing Hitler speaking at public meetings. On the 16th of November, he spoke for the first time in the Sportpalast in Berlin. The gigantic hall was packed to capacity by the time he arrived, accompanied by fanfares and banner-waving SA men. The atmosphere bore little resemblance to a conventional political meeting. His speech on the struggle that will sometime break the chains was repeatedly interrupted by storms of applause. There was nothing new in the speech. Presentation, not content, was what counted. As always, the appeal was solely to the emotions. The revolution, pacifism, internationalism, democracy were all inevitably castigated. Economic recovery could only be brought about through national freedom. And the premise of freedom is power. For this, heroic leaders were needed. Hitler did not explicitly refer to the Jewish question, but he soon turned to his central obsession of racial defilement. The bastardization of culture, morals, and blood was undermining the value of the individual. But a people that resists the bastardization of its spirit and blood can be saved. The German people has its specific value and cannot be set on an equal level to 70 million Negroes. Negro music is dominant, but if we put a Beethoven symphony alongside a shimmy, victory is clear. From our strong faith, the strength will come to deploy self-help against this bastardization. That is the aim that the NSDAP has set itself, to lift the terms nationalism and socialism out of their previous meaning. To be national can only mean to be behind your people, and to be socialist can only be to stand up for the right of your people. Also externally. With this vaguest of definitions, he was keeping open the appeal to all sections of society. Class divisions could only be overcome by national unity. The NSDAP stood above classes. It was not purely nationalist or socialist, bourgeois or proletarian, but stood for all who honestly want to construct the national community, put aside class pride and conceit in order to fight together. As a result, he went on, the party is a movement which can call itself with pride a workers' party because there is no one in it who is not toiling and working for the existence of the people. The NSDAP was engaged in a gigantic struggle against internationalism. It did not rest on votes and the error of democracy, but on the authority of the leader. This was the way to overcoming Marxism and attaining the land and soil that would remove Germany's slavery. He ended by pouring scorn on the speaking ban that had succeeded in filling the biggest hall in the Reich, and with an appeal to God to bless Germany's struggle. The crowd went delirious. Critical observers could remain uncomprehending at a mélange of half-truths, distortions, oversimplifications, and vague, pseudo-religious, redemptionist promises. But the 16,000 people jammed into the Sportpalast had not turned up to listen to an intellectual discourse. They had heard what they had come to hear. By the time Hitler spoke in the Sportpalast, the first dark clouds were already gathering over Germany's economy. The mounting crisis in agriculture was leading to widespread indebtedness, bankruptcies, forced sales of land, and enormous bitterness in the farming community. In the biggest industrial belt, Ruhr industrialists refused to accept an arbitration award and locked out the whole workforce of the iron and steel industry, leaving 230,000 workers without jobs or wages for weeks. Meanwhile, unemployment was sharply on the rise, reaching almost 3 million by January 1929, an increase of 1 million over the previous year. Politically, too, there were growing difficulties. The Grand Coalition, under the SPD Chancellor Hermann Müller, was shaky from the outset. A split and serious loss of face for the SPD occurred over the decision to build a battle cruiser, a policy opposed by the Social Democrats before the election. The Ruhr iron dispute further opened the rifts in the government and exposed it to its critics on left and right. It was the first shot of the concerted attempt by the conservative right to roll back the social advances made in the Weimar welfare state. The ensuing conflict over social policy would ultimately lead to the demise of the Müller government, and by the end of the year, the reparations issue began to loom again. It would become acute in 1929. Remarkably, as intelligent an analyst as the sociologist Joseph Schumpeter could still, in autumn 1928, look with unclouded optimism at the growing stability of our social relations. More precipient was the Reich Foreign Minister Gustav Stresemann, who warned in November 1928 of the dire consequences for Germany should America withdraw its short-term credits on which the economy had rested in the previous years. In reality, the golden years of Weimar had been less golden than they had seemed. Germany had been throughout a society profoundly divided. The brief interlude of relative stability had done nothing to diminish the depth of the class and confessional fissures. Social grievances remained acute. Relatively high levels of unemployment, over 2 million were out of work in 1926, radicalized many workers, a good number of them young. Small shopkeepers and producers felt threatened and angered by department stores and consumer cooperatives, along with many craftsmen feeling their traditional status and livelihood undermined by modern mass production, and white-collar workers keen to keep their distance from blue-collar wage earners. They had no affection for Weimar democracy, even in its best years. Farmers, as already mentioned, were up in arms at the collapse of agricultural prices. Culturally, the divisions were equally acute. Weimar avant-garde art forms repelled far more people than they attracted. Cultural conservatism and Philistinism were, as ever, closely allied. Popular culture was equally decried. Goebbels's attacks on asphalt culture would later find an echo not just among hardcore Nazis, but among a solid reactionary bourgeoisie alienated by the Americanization of big-city popular culture in the 1920s. The sharply divided social milieus and subcultures were reflected in a highly unstable political landscape. The 1928 election had only at the most superficial glance been a success for democracy. The increased KPD vote marked a shift away from democracy on the left. The liberal parties of the center and center-right had lost an alarming proportion of their support since 1919. Their disintegration and fragmentation reflected disillusionment with democracy and a rightward shift of voters even before the Nazis made a significant electoral mark. On the nationalist right, the loss of support by the DNVP was only at first sight a comfort to Democrats. Many of the party's erstwhile supporters had drifted still further to the right, into a variety of interest and protest parties that would ultimately be swept into the NSDAP. Above all, Weimar democracy was unable, even in its golden years, to win a firm enough base of support to counter those powerful sectors of society that opposed its very existence. Its problem of legitimacy remained acute. Renewed economic crisis would evidently pose an immense threat. And here, as Stresemann had emphasized, stability was far less assured than the outward glitter of the Golden Twenties suggested. The German economy depended upon American short-term loans. Its own productivity and investment lagged. Profitability was declining as wages were rising, public finances were coming increasingly under strain, and a heavily subsidized agricultural sector was lurching into deep crisis following a collapse of world food prices at least 2 years before the Wall Street crash. In the worsening conditions of the winter of 1928-9, the NSDAP began to attract increasing support. By the end of 1928, the number of membership cards distributed had reached 108,717. Social groups that had scarcely been reached before could now be tapped. In November 1928, Hitler received a rapturous reception from 2,500 students at Munich University. Before he spoke, the meeting had been addressed by the recently appointed Reich leader of the Nazi Students' Federation, the 21-year-old Baldur von Schirach. The future Hitler Youth leader came from a highly cultured bourgeois family based in Weimar, Germany's literary capital, where his father had been a highly regarded director of the court theatre. Unusually for a leading Nazi, he spoke excellent English. His American mother, with imperfect command of the language of her adopted country, had spoken only English to him in his childhood, so that at the age of 6 he spoke, so he later said, not a word of German. The end of the war had brought tragedy for the Schirachs. Baldur's father lost his job, his brother Karl committed suicide, despairing at the block on his officer's career as a consequence of the Versailles Treaty, and attributing his decision to kill himself to Germany's misfortune. In Weimar, a town conscious of past glories, but by now infested with Völkisch nationalist and anti-Semitic clamour, Baldur had found his way, helped by his mentor, later deputy Gauleiter in Thuringia, Hans Severus Ziegler, into a paramilitary youth organization, and was an admirer of Ludendorff before, for the first time, hearing Hitler speak at the time of the elections for Reich president in March 1925. So thrilled was he at the experience that he ran home and wrote a poem about Hitler, which was published, bringing him a signed photograph from his hero. He devoured the first volume of Mein Kampf in a single evening and joined the party at the beginning of May. He was Hitler's man, and would see to it that the Führer cult would flourish in the infant Nazi youth organization and in the Students' League. By late 1928, Schirach could gain credit for a big increase in the Nazi vote in student union elections, up to 32% in Erlangen and 20% in Greifswald and Würzburg. The success secured him Hitler's support, paving the way for him to take over the leadership of the Hitler Youth in 1931. The student union elections gave Hitler an encouraging sign of gathering Nazi strength, but it was above all in the countryside, among the radicalized peasants, that the Nazis began to make particularly rapid advances. In Schleswig-Holstein, bomb attacks on government offices gave the clearest indication of the mood in the farming community. In January 1929, radicalized peasants in the region founded the Landvolk, an inchoate but violent protest movement that rapidly became prey to Nazi inroads. 2 months later, following an NSDAP meeting in the village of Verden, a fight between SA men and KPD supporters led to 2 stormtroopers being killed and a number of others injured. Local reactions showed graphically the potential for Nazi gains in the disaffected countryside. There was an immediate upsurge in Nazi support in the locality. Old peasant women now wore the party badge on their work smocks. From conversations with them, ran the police report, it was clear that they had no idea of the aims of the party. But they were certain that the government was incapable and the authorities were squandering taxpayers' money. They were convinced that only the National Socialists could be the saviors from this alleged misery. Farmers spoke of a Nazi victory through Parliament taking too long. A civil war was what was needed. The mood was extraordinarily embittered, and the population were open to all forms of violent action. Using the incident as a propaganda opportunity, Hitler attended the funeral of the dead SA men and visited those wounded. This made a deep impression on the local inhabitants. He and the other leading Nazis were applauded as liberators of the people. As the crisis before the crisis, economic and political, deepened, Hitler kept up his propaganda offensive. In the first half of 1929, he wrote 10 articles for the party press and held 16 major speeches before large, rapturous audiences. 4 were in Saxony during the run-up to the state elections there on the 12th of May. Outright attacks on the Jews did not figure in the speeches. The emphasis was on the bankruptcy at home and abroad of the Weimar system, the exploitation of international finance, and the suffering of small people, the catastrophic economic consequences of democratic rule, the social divisions that party politics caused and replicated, and above all, the need to restore German strength and unity and gain the land to secure its future. "The key to the world market has the shape of the sword," he declared. "The only salvation from decline was through power. The entire system must be altered. Therefore the great task is to restore to people their belief in leadership. Führer glauben," he concluded. Hitler's speeches were part of a well-organized propaganda campaign, providing saturation coverage of Saxony before the election. It was planned by Himmler, but under Hitler's own supervision. The growing numerical strength of the party and the improvements made in its organization and structure now allowed more extensive coverage. This in turn helped to create an image of dynamism, drive, and energy. Local activism and the winning of influential figures in a community usually held the key to Nazi progress. Hitler had to be used sparingly, for best effect, as well as to avoid too punishing a schedule.